From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Tucson, Arizona.
Proposition 200 is an extremist ballot initiative that would require everyone in Arizona to present proof of citizenship, to register to vote, and to receive any public service, and it will require all public employees here to report anyone who they suspect is undocumented to the immigration authorities.
Today in Arizona, a referendum that could lead to many others like it in the country. Then out-of-state students are warned they could face felonies if they register to vote in Arizona.
We were out on the U of A mall registering voters. It was a very successful day. And then Fox News came and told us we could be encouraging students to commit felonies.
We'll also speak with a professor at the University of Arizona whose student reported him to the FBI for being anti-American. But first, the death toll from the hurricanes that have rocked the Caribbean and Florida continues to rise. UN peacekeepers deploy in Haiti to stop looting, and the World Food Program warns that many face starvation. We'll get a report from the Caribbean. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting live from Tucson, Arizona. Secretary of State Colin Powell admitted Sunday the resistance against the U.S. presence in Iraq is intensifying. In an interview on ABC's This Week, Powell said, quote, "It's getting worse, and the reason it's getting worse is that they're determined to disrupt the election. Iraq has seen another bloody weekend that left dozens dead across the country. In Mosul, up to four members of the Iraqi National Guard were killed earlier today in a car bombing. The attack comes 2 days after seven members of the Guard were killed in an ambush in western Baghdad. Overnight, at least five Iraqis died in U.S. air attacks in the Sadr City section of Baghdad. U.S. air attacks have also continued in Fallujah. At least 27 people have died over the past 2 days there. One of the deadliest incidents of the weekend occurred in Latifiyah, south of Baghdad. 10 people died, 26 wounded when a group of gasoline tankers were attacked. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal is reporting as many as 30,000 Iraqi Christians have fled the country since a string of church bombings in August. It marks the largest religious exodus since the 1950s and 60s, when many of the Iraqi Jewish community left the country. And at least four U.S. troops died over the weekend, bringing the monthly death toll to 63. September is on pace to become one of the deadliest months so far for U.S. forces. In other Iraq news, the U.S. military has arrested a senior commander in the U.S.-trained Iraqi National Guard. The brigadier general was arrested on suspicion he was collaborating with the Iraqi resistance. The arrest raises new questions on the loyalty of the U.S.-trained troops. Meanwhile, Pentagon is preparing to send 800 unarmed members of the 98th Army Reserve Division from Rochester, New York, to Iraq to train Iraq's new army. The 98th Army Reserve Unit is a non-combat unit that doesn't have its own weapons or vehicles. It normally trains reserve and active duty soldiers in the United States. Leaders of the reserves are worried about the deployment. Lieutenant General James Helmley, chief of the U.S. Army Reserve, said, quote, "This is a hard war, and we frankly, inside the Army Reserve, have not been properly prepared for it." The Financial Times has obtained a report by the Pentagon's Defense Science Board, which has concluded that the U.S. cannot maintain its current troop commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan without a significant increase in the size of the armed forces or scaling back the objectives in each country. In Secretary of State Colin Powell's interview with ABC Sunday, he admitted that anti-Americanism is growing in the Muslim world. He said, quote, "I think that will be overcome in due process, because what the Muslim world will see is that in Afghanistan, 10 million people will have registered to vote on the 9th of October and bring in place a freely elected president." but questions are emerging as to how free the elections will be. The Los Angeles Times is reporting evidence has emerged that U.S. officials may be pressuring Afghan presidential candidates to drop out of the race against the pro-American Hamid Karzai. One Afghan warlord, Mohammed Mohakik, said the U.S. ambassador personally visited his office and offered him a reward for quitting the race. Mohakik said, quote, "He told me to drop out of the elections." Other candidates have reported also being pressured. The U.S. government has denied its meddling in the Afghan election. Meanwhile, the U.S. is helping Karzai campaign by using U.S. military helicopters to fly him to campaign events outside of Kabul. In addition, the U.S. corporation DynCorp is providing him with bodyguards. In Syria, a military commander with Hamas was assassinated Sunday when a car bomb exploded. Israel has not officially acknowledged it carried out the attack, but numerous press accounts cite unnamed Israeli officials saying that the Sharon government had a role in the killing. It's believed to be the first assassination carried out by Israel inside Syria. Israel's deputy premier, Ehud Olmert, warned Palestinian fighters that Israel will attack in, quote, every place, every corner. Hamas warned that the assassination may force them to target Israeli interests outside of Israel and the occupied territories for the first time. The group said Israel has, quote, opened a new door for the struggle by transferring the battle outside Palestine. Syria and Jordan condemned the killing as a terrorist act. Meanwhile, Newsweek's reporting, the Pentagon is updating plans for possible U.S. military action against Syria and Iran. The magazine reports the Pentagon unit responsible for military planning for the two nations is, quote, busier than ever. For the fourth time in 6 weeks, Florida has been hit by a major hurricane. Hurricane Jean left at least five people dead and caused billions of dollars in damage. 2.5 million homes lost power. Florida became the first state since 1886 to be hit with four hurricanes in one season. Meanwhile, in Haiti, the death toll from flooding caused by the storm has reached at least 1,500. Some 300,000 people are now homeless. Residents of Gonaïves have complained the Haitian government in Port-au-Prince has offered little assistance. One aid worker told the New York Times, quote, "We're having trouble organizing the distribution because there's no authority existing in the town. The government is absolutely not responding," he said. CBS News has taken the unusual step of publicly admitting that it has killed a major story because the network feels it would be, quote, inappropriate to air it before the presidential election. The story is the result of a major six-month investigation into how the Bush administration obtained forged documents that made it appear Saddam Hussein was trying to buy uranium from the African nation of Niger. The uranium claim was cited by President Bush during his 2002 State of the Union address as a reason to go to attack Iraq. The segment was originally to air on September 29th, but was pulled to make room for the now infamous segment on President Bush's military records. Meanwhile, a leaked memo from the Environmental Protection Agency has revealed that the EPA has ordered its entire staff to refrain from answering inquiries from the press in the lead-up to the November election in order to, quote, prevent EPA management from being surprised by news coverage. The memo was released last week by the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. The head of the watchdog group said, quote, "This policy shows the EPA political leadership's profound fear of the expertise of its own professional staff."
Killed your sister's child or built in my hometown, but we dare not speak a word of that or risk a sideways frown. Oh, there's nothing you can do but watch the news and fret. Our desert skies are thundering with returning jets. I should feel patriotic, all blue and white and red, but the sky of black in Iraq replays in my head. The screen in living color portraying you and me. Between the death and dying, glamorizing SUVs. We sacrificed our freedom in the hopes that we'd be free. Oh, Jerusalem, where the prophets are estranged. Our mighty leaders pray out loud, home out of range.
My Hometown, sung by Kathleen Williamson here in Tucson, about Tucson, Arizona, where we're broadcasting from today. Democracy Now! And democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As Florida is devastated by yet another hurricane, the death toll in the Caribbean continues to rise. On Saturday, the Bahamas was hit hard by Hurricane Jeanne, knocking out electricity and causing flooding in some areas of the country. In nearby Haiti, the situation remains dire, with more than 1,500 people dead, more than 1,000 missing. On Sunday, Haitian officials said more bodies were recovered from the debris in the third largest city of Gonaïves. Meanwhile, the United Nations is deploying more peacekeepers in Haiti to curb looting that broke out in the wake of the devastation. The general in charge of the UN operations in Haiti said many people were suffering from diarrhea, while others, many of them children, were contracting gangrene. He said amputations are being performed under horrendous conditions. Most injuries being treated are gashes from collapsing roofs or pieces of zinc roof hidden by the mud that still covers the city, where most survivors walk barefoot. The World Food Program said relief agencies are working around the clock trying to get food to victims amid fears that many people remain in danger of starvation. We're joined now by John Maxwell. He is a veteran Jamaican journalist, has covered the Caribbean for more than 40 years, currently a columnist for the Jamaica Observer. He joins us on the telephone from Kingston. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John Maxwell.
Morning, Amy. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the effects of these hurricanes on the Caribbean?
Well, the point is that we are, and we have always been, hurricane prone. This is where the hurricanes end up after crossing the Atlantic. So, you know, we expect, once upon a time when I was a child, Jamaica used to say that we had a hurricane every 7 years. Well, that is not exactly correct, but the forecasters, Professor William Gray and company in Colorado, have predicted that we're entering a period of even more intense hurricane activity. That's more hurricanes, and the hurricanes are going to be stronger, more intense, more dangerous, more damaging. At the same time, with the whole globalization, liberalization, privatization, you know, the whole new capitalist program, there are a lot more poor people, a lot more displaced people, people living on hillsides and gullies, on land that nobody else wants. And that is a recipe for disaster, because they live in places which are subject to flooding or landslides or just the effects of the wind alone, and their houses are flimsy, so that they can't put up any, the houses don't put up any, don't give them any protection against the wind. So you can expect in all of the Caribbean, but particularly in Haiti, because that is the poorest of the poor. You can expect a lot more of these disasters over the next few years. And, of course, the point about these disasters is that the hurricanes are one part of it, but the conditions under which people are forced to live is a major part of it, and that's what creates the disaster when people are put in harm's way, they cannot defend themselves. And in the case of Haiti, where the American policies over the last 8 years or so have made Haiti completely defenseless. It has stripped Haiti of its vegetation. You know, not only were the trees chopped down during the American occupation so they could plant all sorts of things like sisal and pineapples and coffee, but the poverty of the country, which is directly caused by the fact that the Americans have never allowed Haiti to govern itself and have reneged on promises to Aristide, for instance, to have built a civil defense, police force, that sort of thing, means that the people are completely defenseless. So my feeling is that if there are 3,000 or 5,000 dead, first of all, we never really know. And we're going to get some incredible disasters in Haiti and in the rest of the Caribbean in quite near future. Hmm. Part of global warming is making the Caribbean even warmer, and that means that we're going to attract bigger hurricanes, because the warmer the sea surface temperature is, the more you produce low pressure areas which suck in the hurricanes as they come across the Atlantic.
So we're talking about these twin hurricanes of weather and of poverty and what happens when they combine into one. We quoted the New York Times earlier, an aid worker in Port-au-Prince saying, "We're having trouble organizing the distribution because there is no authority existing in the town. The government is absolutely not responding." Can you talk about the political context here and how that can feed into the devastation, the further devastation of this population that is being hit so hard by the hurricane in Haiti?
Well, the thing to remember is that when Aristide was deposed by American action in at the end of February, the people who took over under the protection of the U.S. Marines were a ragtag bunch of thugs and bandits, convicted murderers, rapists, and just, you know, bad types. These people didn't go in there to set up any administration. They went in there to get money. And they have, nothing has been set up in, we have an administration. But beyond that, they went out and attacked the Aristide party, the people who supported Aristide, Lavalas, which was the glue that held the society together. You know, the leadership, the community leadership, which would provide an early warning system or a rescue system, you know, an emergency management system. That has been totally destroyed because the people who, the Lavalas people have been hunted like dogs. Many of them are dead, some of them are in prison, and a lot of them are in hiding. So that what you have is a decapitation of the Haitian society. It doesn't have a head, it doesn't have a nervous system anymore. And all you have are these people with their guns standing around looking important and talking about, "We are the government." You know, so in a situation like that, nothing is going to, the people from outside are going to have to organize everything. In a place like Jamaica, however inadequate the government is, we have an Office of Disaster Management. And this is true right through the Caribbean. We have this going on. And, you know, we can go in and we can deliver food to people and we can keep order. We can get medical services. We can get water to them. In Haiti, there is no clean water to start with. And when you have a disaster like this, you are talking about an epidemic of really dire proportions, to use the word you used earlier in the program.
Very briefly, John Maxwell, the rest of the Caribbean, the particular islands hardest hit.
Grenada has been really flattened. And part of the reason for that is that Grenada is not used to hurricanes, so they don't build for hurricanes. Hispaniola, the Dominican Republic was also hit. And in Barbados, there's some damage. But basically, Jamaica is worse set apart from Haiti. We are having our problems too, because we don't have any money. The state has been pauperized, and you know, we have to depend on the kindness of friends. But we have a functioning government, you know, which is quite different from what happens in Haiti. So,
well, John Maxwell, I want to thank you for your report. John Maxwell speaking to us from Kingston, Jamaica, veteran Jamaican journalist, covered the Caribbean affairs for more than 40 years, currently a columnist for the Jamaica Observer. Thank you for joining us. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we spend time here in Tucson, Arizona, and talk about Arizona and how it could affect the rest of the country in the coming election. Stay with us.
No, no, no. No. Nothing less than freedom.
When there is injustice, do you think, how could they have done this? Turn your back on the action. Someone else will maintain the reaction. What about all of the lies told? Been ingrained since the missionary songbooks and school books on history. Too many children, their own rules of mystery. No, 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 no. Where do we go? We need to know. No, 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 no. We won't accept any less than freedom.
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 Nothing less than.
No, no, freedom. Freedom. We won't accept. It don't affect you directly, so you ignore, think you'll never be infected. When money can't buy you green trees, would you have help since now you can't breathe? You think material will save you with this rise or the other side?
Oh, Maya, nothing less than freedom. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Tucson, Arizona, from the studios of Access Tucson, public access TV here in Tucson. It's wonderful to be back. We're right here near the border, celebrating last night at Centennial Hall at the University of Arizona, both Access Tucson and the community radio station here in town, KXCI. Well, today we're going to talk about issues here in Arizona. Both John Kerry and George W. Bush have been intensifying their campaign efforts in a handful of so-called battleground states, states whose voters could change the outcome of the November election, places like Ohio, Colorado, Wisconsin, and the state we're broadcasting from today, Arizona. The voters of this state are characterized as being fiercely independent. In addition to the high stakes of the presidential and national elections this year, Arizona voters face a highly controversial measure called the Taxpayer and Citizens Protection Act, also known as Proposition 200. If passed, the measure would force all Arizonans to present their birth certificate or passports to receive public services and to vote. It would require public employees to report anyone who can't present these documents to federal immigration authorities. It imposes up to 4 months of jail time on any public employee, including doctors, teachers, firefighters, librarians, social workers, and others who make an error in enforcing immigration laws. In a moment, we'll be joined by Alexis Mazon, who is an organizer with the Coalition to Defeat Prop 200. But first, we want to get an overview of this battleground state where one of the presidential debates will take place with Stephen Farley, a Tucson-based artist and activist. In 1999, he founded a nonprofit called Voices, Community Stories Past and Present, which runs after-school programs that employ at-risk youth to interview Tucson residents and publish books and magazines of community stories and photographs. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Thanks, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you give us the lay of the land of Arizona, what you think are the key issues right now?
Well, Arizona is really in flux, and we're lucky it's in flux because it's coming from a pretty sorry past. We're, our legislature is well known as being one of the wackiest in the country. It's legislated such things as putting on bounties for endangered wolves and incentives to encourage companies that produce CFCs to come to Arizona. And it's been dominated in
what
large part. Companies that produce chlorofluorocarbons that had, at the time, been outlawed internationally. The legislature encouraged them to come to Arizona and produce them. It's been dominated in large part in the past by some pretty wacky Republicans from the East Valley in Phoenix, and they're still there. And in fact, in the recent Republican primaries, the furthest right candidates were the ones who won. Anybody who actually tried to moderate and compromise with our Democratic governor, Governor Napolitano, was ousted in those Republican primaries, which is not a good sign of the way things are going. However, here in Tucson, it's one of the few places where it's safe to be a little left of center. We have the most progressive member of Congress is our congressional representative, Raul Grijalva, who is absolutely incredible. He's running for re-election, and the Republican the voters in the primary decide to put against him is a guy named Joe Sweeney, who has been quoted in the local papers as saying, quote, "I hate Mexicans," and, quote, "Hell yes, I'm a racist." So it's kind of an interesting campaign, and it sums up a lot of sort of the polarization that has been happening in this state. The interesting thing about that polarization that I don't think the Republicans really fully count on is that it has mobilized voters to an incredible extent. And almost all the campaigns for progressive causes and Democratic causes have been focusing almost entirely on registering new voters to totally change the game. And that's why I think we have a real opportunity to really break out in this election. We have registered an unprecedented number of Democratic voters, outnumbering the Republican new registrants by, I think, around 8 to 10 to 1. It's amazing, and I think what's going to happen is people are so motivated by the blatant racist appeals by Republican candidates and by these Prop 200 advocates that they're going to get out there and they're going to vote in record numbers. As traditionally, we've had a trouble with turnout on some of the more Latino parts of Tucson. That's not going to be the case this time. We're going to be getting everyone to the polls, and we're going to be turning Arizona blue indeed.
In our next segment, we're going to talk about some young women students who were out trying to register voters and what happened when a Fox affiliate truck rolled up. A reporter got out and said they could be encouraging people to commit felonies by encouraging out-of-state students to register. It turned out that that was not the case, that it is not a crime, and that out-of-state students can vote. But on other issues, for example, like water in Arizona, how significant is that?
It's a huge issue, and it's one that's being ignored by a large part by a lot of the power structure here, because one of the main forces of the economy, particularly in southern Arizona, is the development industry. We are ground zero for sprawl in the state. And luckily, the voters were wise enough to pass something called the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan in May. And that plan enables the county to buy up endangered open spaces and keep it preserved for all eternity so that the developers cannot simply sprawl and blade all of the Sonoran Desert that we have around here. Unfortunately, developers do have an inordinate amount of power in a lot of other areas. And one of those is making sure that they maintain a water supply, or at least maintain the fiction of a water supply. In Tucson here, we're actually, up until a couple of years ago, we were the largest civic area in the country totally dependent on aquifer. And as we grew at an incredible pace, we grow 2 to 3% a year in population. We were draining that aquifer alarmingly fast. It was quite controversial, but we came in and brought in some water from the Colorado River to supposedly solve our water problems. But for those of you who've looked at Colorado River issues, basically the entire Southwest is draining off the Colorado River, and at this point, it dwindles off into nothing before it even reaches the Gulf of California. At this point.
We're talking to Steve Farley, who is an activist and artist in Tucson. His organization is called Voices, Community Stories Past and Present. We're also joined by Alexis Mazon, who is an organizer with the Coalition to Defeat Prop 200. Alexis, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you lay out this proposition?
Well, as you mentioned, Prop 200 will require everyone in our state to start presenting proof of citizenship, which is a passport or a birth certificate or a tribal identity card, every time they have any contact with a government agency, a city agency, a county agency, a state agency. And the public employees serving Arizonans will now be required to ask for that documentation and assess the citizenship status of everyone who comes in seeking services. And if they make an error in assessing someone's status, or if they refuse to comply with Prop 200, which many of us will as public employees, they can face up to 4 months in jail or Class 2 misdemeanor charges.
What do you mean, which many of you will? You're a public employee?
Yes.
And so what does that mean? What could you be asked to do? What won't you do if this proposition were passed?
Well, Prop 200 will require us to ask everyone what their citizenship status is and to present proof of it. So if I don't, and we'll have to be retrained in federal immigration law, which none of us were hired to enforce in the first place, and if we find that someone is undocumented under Prop 200, we are required to make a written report to INS or ICE, and if we don't do so, if we don't report someone for deportation, we will be faced with criminal charges.
Who is behind the proposition?
Prop 200 comes out of the Phoenix area. A group called Protect Arizona Now began gathering signatures for this about a year ago. And then they received about $500,000 from FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. And FAIR came in and paid $3 a signature. In Maricopa County primarily, and they were able to get enough signatures for the ballot. They've also been receiving support from national white separatist organizations. They have a national agenda. They're receiving funding from these outside organizations. And the leaders are tied to white supremacist groups and other anti-immigrant groups, anti-Semitic groups that are prominent in national efforts. They're running anti-immigrant candidates in 9 other states, and Tom Tancredo, for example, in Colorado is involved in this effort. And in fact, these same characters were run out of Colorado in March. They had a similar initiative. It was a proposal in the state legislature, and it failed there, as it will fail here when it's put to the voters of Arizona, because we believe that if people find out the truth about what this means for all of us, that on a routine basis, the government is going to be intruding into our personal information. When we go to the library to check out a book, when we go to the hospital to get treatment, when we take our children to after school programs, we're going to be required to present proof of citizenship.
Now, the argument that the Prop 200 proponents have put forward is that they are pushing for this measure to stop voter fraud and to stop welfare fraud. Can you respond in both cases?
Sure. This is a popular message that they use, but the fact is that there hasn't been a single case of voter fraud in the state of Arizona by an immigrant. All the county recorder's offices of this state have verified this. Welfare fraud is practically non-existent by immigrants. Immigrants take very few government services in this state. They're prohibited from receiving most public benefits.
Steve Farley.
In fact, it was interesting to me to read recently that the Associated Press discovered that immigrants actually contribute $6 billion a year to the Social Security Fund that they never use. And that has added up to over $376 billion in Social Security funds earned by illegal immigrants that have never been used, that are currently propping up our Social Security system ourselves.
So these are undocumented workers.
These are undocumented workers who have contributed $376 billion to our Social Security system directly.
But
you never hear about that. They never actually get it. We benefit from that. It's ironic that they're now looking at saying that they're draining our economy when, in fact, they're helping.
What would it mean in the next election if this were to pass when it comes to actually voting? What would you have to do? What kind of ID, or do you have to show any kind of ID right now?
You don't currently have to show ID to vote. You give your name. They look your name up on a list, and and you're given a ballot. Under Prop 200, you would be required to present valid ID. And, we have one of the lowest voter turnout rates in the country. We're 49th or 50th consistently. We've been under federal monitoring since the late 70s because of a long legacy of voter abuse and harassment by KKK groups, Arizona. And this is another way to intimidate voters, and it's another hurdle to put up. We won't be able to do clipboard registration of voters in the future, going door-to-door, going to public events. We're going to have a copy machine to get people's documents in order to do that. And what people don't realize is there's already a very complex system in place. When you submit a voter registration form, they verify signature, address, citizenship, your social security number is required. There's already a bureaucracy there to verify and ensure against fraud. So we don't need this. This is just going to be another barrier to people of color and the elderly and the disabled and other groups from voting in our state.
Who is opposing Prop 200 in Arizona in terms of groups and politicians, like, for example, Senator McCain, who's Republican, your governor, who's Democrat?
We've seen an unprecedented opposition rise up against this because we've had the Chamber of Commerce, the entire congressional delegation, the Libertarian Party, the Green Party. We've had, of course, civil rights groups, church groups, human rights groups, the unions. SEIU has filed two lawsuits against this. So we're sitting at a table together to oppose and mobilize against Prop 200 with people that we don't typically sit with. But and that's why we're hopeful that we can defeat this if we can get the word out to voters. Our obstacle right now is that about 60% of Arizona likely voters believe the hype that they're hearing about Prop 200 and are favoring Prop 200, even though we have very broad opposition to it by our leadership and our governor and then our community organizations.
Senator McCain is opposed.
Senator McCain, John Kyle, and Congressman Grijalva, Colby, people who don't agree on...
Senator Colby, a Republican.
Right.
Rather, Congressman.
Representative.
Yeah, Congressman. Member Colby, they're all opposed. But the polls show that it will pass.
Well, no. The polls show that right now about 60% of voters are in favor, but most people we've talked to don't even know about Prop 200 yet. So we're on a mission to inform voters through a ground campaign and an air campaign about what this really is and how this is an attack on civil liberties of all Arizonans, not just on migrant workers. And we believe that if we can get that word out, that we will defeat this resoundingly. This is very much like Prop 187 in terms of what it does. It's worse in a lot of ways because it criminalizes public employees and it turns everyone in this state into an immigration agent. But we think that, unlike in the Prop 187 situation 10 years ago, with so much multi-partisan opposition, we just need to get the word out to voters about what this will do, and they will vote against it, as we will.
I was surprised to read an editorial op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal by Tamar Jacoby, called Flawed Proposition, a Ballot Initiative That's Bad for Arizona and for America. And she is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, which is an extremely conservative organization that they, too, are opposing Prop 200.
I think conservatives are afraid that this is really showing their true colors, and they don't want that to happen. I mean, that's why the local Republican Party had arguments whether or not they should support this guy, Joe Sweeney, who is basically a self-confessed racist, who's running against Representative Raul Grijalva.
He had attempted to get the nomination many times before.
Oh,
this.
Yeah. He'd run 16 different times, and this time he got 70% of the vote in the primary to run against him, which was kind of interesting. The thing is, it's issues like this that really are starting to divide the Republican Party here. I mean, some of the far right wing in this state in particular has been overplaying its hand for quite a few years. And there's actually a more moderate Republican group called Mainstream Arizona that's been trying to, quote, take back the party for the moderate Goldwater, amazingly enough, wing. These folks are far to the right of Goldwater. And it's really dividing the party, and I think that could be one of the positive things that comes out of this, is you see people taking the far right and running with it. All of a sudden, there are people who have been Republicans their whole lives thinking, wait a minute, what's going on here? So I think that's a positive thing that could come out of something so egregious. One of the most chilling things about this proposition in particular is how it enables anyone in the state to be able to sue any public employee if they suspect that public employee has not turned in the names of the people they suspect of being illegal, which creates a situation in which everyone's informing on everyone else within the state. And that type of society, incredible. And I think that's part of why even some people on the conservative right also are opposing this.
Hmm. Alexis, the last word.
Well, Arizona is a state that has been pummeled by right-wing rhetoric, anti-immigrant rhetoric about border militarization and the need for border security. And that fear is what the proponents of Prop 200 are capitalizing on now. There's no question we have real problems in this state. We have one of the lowest rates of health insurance coverage. People are angry about that, and they have every right to be. We have one of the lowest spending budgets for education. Our public services in general are very, very underfunded, and that's a problem, and we need to address it. But it's not fair and it's not accurate to blame the migrant workers of this state, who contribute hundreds of millions more dollars in taxes every year than they take in services, who pay up over $1 billion just in rent and mortgage payments every year in Arizona. It's not accurate to say that they are responsible for this. We have a federal government that is slashing social services, and we need to do something about that. But passing legislation like Prop 200 and hate mongering against the most vulnerable groups in our state is not the way to approach this. And we know that they're going to be successful promoting this message in other states. Arizona is a border state. We have a unique situation here. But they're trying to go everywhere with this. And we need to defeat it right now so that it won't get any further.
Alexis Mezzolin, I want to thank you for being with us with the organization Coalition to Defeat Prop 200. Also, Stephen Farley, Tucson-based artist and activist. His organization is called Voices, Community Stories Past and Present.
Amy, can I give our website in case people around the country want to support our campaign? It's www.defeat200.org. And we are a grassroots effort, and we need grassroots support to defeat this.
Well, thank you both for joining us. I should also say recently I was at Colorado College, where a number of the students this summer went from Colorado to Arizona to work with an organization called No More Deaths. They went into the desert and they helped immigrants who had come across the border and who were in the desert and were suffering from dehydration, were lost. Also other organizations in this area like Humane Borders, which very much spring out of the sanctuary movement of a quarter of a century ago, when people in this area helped immigrants coming across the border who were being persecuted in their own countries all too often, that were supported by the U.S. government, military regimes in El Salvador and Guatemala. I want to thank you very much for being with us. When we come back, we're going to talk to some young women students who thought they were doing a good thing, trying to get other students registered. We'll find out what happened. Stay with us. Erica Badu. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Tucson, Arizona, from the studios of Access Tucson. As the November election draws nearer, get-out-the-vote campaigns are intensifying across the country. Many analysts predict an unprecedented number of people will register to vote. But here in Arizona, a group of students at the University of Arizona charge they're being harassed for encouraging students to vote. Late last month, students in the Women's Studies Honorary Society, in conjunction with the Feminist Majority Foundation, gathered on the lawn of the University of Arizona registering voters. They called the drive Suffrage 2004. They were engaging in an activity that is common on many campuses nationwide. In recent weeks on the Arizona campus, the college Democrats, Republicans, and student government had run similar drives. But this one was different. As the students gathered on the lawn doing voter registration, the local Fox News affiliate pulled up to the site and, with cameras rolling, accused the students of helping other students commit felonies. But we'll let the students tell the story right now. We're joined by Kelly Krause, who is president of the University of Arizona Network of Feminist Student Activists. The network is an affiliate of the Feminist Majority Foundation. And we're joined by Sarah Ransom, who is with the National Lawyers Guild student chapter at the University of Arizona. We welcome you both to Democracy
Now! Thank you.
Kelly, let's start with you. Okay, describe what happened. When were you doing this?
Okay, August 31st, we were holding Suffrage 2004 event, right? And our goal was to try to register and mobilize young women to celebrate the fight of suffragists by exercising the right to vote. And we spent the day out on the U of A Mall, and it was a great success. We registered over 130 students. And then at the end of the day, we were packing up, and the Fox 11 news crew came, and they told us we were encouraging students to commit a felony by registering to vote. And it was really unfortunate because the hard work of all those involved, plus the excitement of all the newly registered students, was really tainted by this misinformation.
So they were accusing you of helping students commit a crime by doing what?
By registering to vote in Arizona. Because technically, the law says that you have to have physical intent 29 days before the election, plus the intent to remain. And the Registrar of Voters was interpreting that to mean that you had to intend on being in Arizona as a student after you graduated from college.
Let's go to a clip from the Fox report of the Registrar, Steve Rhodes.
If they're only here to attend school and their intention is to immediately return where they came from when school's over, then they are not residents of the state of Arizona for voting purposes and they cannot register to vote here.
That was Chris Rhodes, the registrar. Sarah Ransom, can you explain what it is he said? Because there have been developments since then.
Yes. What he was essentially claiming was that if you're a student, then you are... Basically, if you're from out of state, that you are per se a temporary resident, and therefore you cannot vote, or else when you sign the voter registration document, you will be committing fraud because you will be claiming to be a resident of Arizona. And I also volunteer to register students to vote through the Feminist Majority Foundation, and I was very disturbed. And so I went and checked into this assertion, and it took me about 20 minutes to realize that everything that Fox News was saying and what Chris Rhodes was saying was actually completely contrary to what the state of the law is in a national presidential election.
What is the law?
The law is very clear. It's actually one of the areas where it's pretty hard to find ambiguity. In 1970, the federal Congress passed the Voting Rights Act amendments, and it explicitly abolishes durational residency requirements.
Durational residency?
Yeah, that's different from residency for the purposes of voting. A durational residency requirement is, let's say in this situation, a student from Oregon, like myself, comes to the University of Arizona, and for your first year, you have to, in order to get in-state tuition, you have to prove to the state that you want to be a resident. You have to pay taxes. You have to register your car. You have to get an Arizona driver's license. And that is what Congress abolished. They found that to be an undue burden on the fundamental right of the students to vote.
And they said you don't have to do all that to vote.
No, and it was upheld by the Supreme Court. States didn't like this because states have traditionally been able to control eligibility requirements for voter registration. And they challenged it, and the Supreme Court in Oregon v. Mitchell held that in a national presidential election, in order to mobilize the national, you know, citizenry to vote, you need to have uniform requirements. And age requirements, it should be 18 uniformly across the country to comport with the 26th Amendment. And also, a durational residency requirement is inappropriate. Rather, you simply have to be a citizen of the state.
So how did this all go down? Fox did a national report. Was it national or is it local, regional, in the area, saying that you, Kelly Krause, were encouraging, or your organization, the Arizona Network of Feminist Student Activists, was encouraging students to commit felonies. And they had the quote of Chris Rhodes, the registrar. So then what happened?
Well, right, they had the support of both the Pima County Registrar and also the Secretary of State when we contacted them right after this incident, basically backed the position of Fox, which was kind of outrageous and really discouraging to all students on campus, because we've all been doing voter registration, all student organizations, under these same pretenses.
The Young Republicans as well.
Everyone, right. And they were actually out on the mall that day also doing voter registration. So it was kind of not a coincidence that it was targeted towards a feminist organization. But we explained to the reporter, because we knew that there was a Supreme Court case that expressly ruled that college students have the right to vote in their college community, but it seemed that she had already made up her mind.
Mm-hmm. So what did the Secretary of State say when you called to say, but the Supreme Court has ruled on
this? Right. Well, the message we were getting from the Secretary of State was unfortunately really ambiguous. Basically, they said they would just read the state, the actual statute, and not interpret it. And then when you'd sort of ask the questions, well, what does that mean? What is the statement of intent, to try to get at those answers, it was just unclear. And that's when this inaccurate interpretation came from the registrar of voters, saying it meant you have to be here indefinitely, be here when you graduate from school.
So how did this all change? Because there have been developments since, and there have been clarifying statements from the registrar, and Fox has done another report. Sarah Ransom.
Well, what we did is we looked at the Arizona state residency requirements for voters, and it does say you need physical presence in the state and the intent to remain. And so we thought, what does intent to remain mean? And since the U.S. Supreme Court is authoritative on this issue, we decided to find out what the U.S. Supreme Court said. And they say unequivocally in a case, Sim v. U.S., that a student, there is no requirement that a student, in order to establish that he is a resident of the place where he wishes to vote, establish that he intends to remain there permanently or for any particular period of time. Therefore, when you look at the Arizona statute, simply students need to have physical presence in Pima County and an intent to remain for the 29 days before the election.
And so the Secretary of State has issued a clarifying statement,
the
Pima County Recorder.
FN Rodriguez.
And Fox has duly reported this?
Right.
Yes.
So yeah, you have
with
won.
Their own spin on it.
Which was?
I mean, Fox was relentless in attempting to portray the students as, for instance, after we held a press conference on September 8th, and they portrayed the students as defiantly registering to vote and telling officials to come and get us, and we have no limits to our right to vote. And then, you know, the phone calls kept coming. Pima County Recorder's Office issued a retraction, stated that Fox had misinterpreted the law, and then they said, And then on September 24th, they ran another report where they stated that it was all the Pima County Recorder's Office, and, oh, but if you're here for 29 days before the election, I guess you can go ahead and register to vote.
Well, congratulations
on your
victory, getting what is a right clarified here in Arizona. Hopefully people have seen the subsequent reports. Sarah Ransom of National Lawyers Guild Student Chapter and Kelly Krause, President of the University of Arizona Network of Feminist Student Activists. We're going to go to a music interlude and then introduce our last guest, a professor whose student turned him in to the FBI. Stay with us.
Segregation, no occupation, world inflation, demonstrations, misinformation.
This is Democracy Now! As we move into our last segment here, broadcasting from Tucson, Arizona, we're joined by Professor David Gibbs, Associate Professor of History and Sociology at the University of Arizona. David Gibbs, this will be the first part of our conversation in this last few minutes. What happened in your class? What did you say, and what did your student do?
Well, I teach a class, a large freshman class, called What is Politics, that focuses on propaganda and deception, and I emphasize instances of government lying and things like that. And the semester I taught it, which was last spring, the Independent Women's Forum put into the... the Independent Women's Forum, being a sort of conservative activist group, put into the local newspaper, local student newspaper, an advertisement that basically argued that there's a kind of left-wing domination of the universities and students should fight that, with the strong implication they should monitor their professors and report them. At least that's how I read it. And that semester I began getting instances of that happening. Specifically on my evaluation, I got, for example, a student who said, "I'm an anti-American communist who hates America and is trying to brainwash young people into thinking America sucks. I should be investigated by the FBI. FBI has been contacted." Another student on a web blog during the summer said he took my class and also said he didn't like my politics and suggested students shouldn't take my class but should drop by and try to disrupt it. And so there have been a number of instances like that, which I hadn't had before.
Mm-hmm. And what does it mean if a student were to report you? What does what happens then?
I don't really know. Whether or not the FBI was in fact contacted, I can't say. I'm not particularly losing sleep over the prospect of an 18-year-old calling the FBI about my politics. I think, though, it's indicative of a larger national trend, which is conservative activist groups with lots of money and connections to the Republican Party are trying to encourage and even to some extent orchestrate students, local conservative student groups like those at the University of Arizona, to go and basically harass faculty if they don't like their politics.
Does it change what you do?
It hasn't changed what I do, no. Whether it does with other faculty, I can't say. Yeah, this is a group, Independent Women's Forum. I've looked on their website, and they're putting these ads similar to the one that was put in the University of Arizona Wildcat in student newspapers across the country.
It's a full-page ad that says, "Top 10 things your professors do to skew you. They push their political views. Liberal opinions dominate. They don't present both sides of the debate. Conservative viewpoints practically non-existent. Classrooms are for learning, not brainwashing. They force you to check your intellectual honesty at the door. They make you uncomfortable if you disagree. Grading should be based on facts, not opinion. Education, more like indoctrination." That's the ad. We're going to continue our conversation after the show, and we'll broadcast it later on Democracy Now! Professor Gibbs, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Today we head to Yuma, Arizona, where we'll be tonight. Tomorrow we'll be broadcasting from Phoenix. Tomorrow night we'll be doing an event, the Exception to the Ruler's Book and Media Tour in Phoenix. And then we will head on to Santa Fe. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, and Jeremy Scahill. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. We're broadcasting from Access Tucson here in Tucson. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.